philosophy with respect to our situation here in this present material existence and the Lord from whom this entire cosmic manifestation has come. Sambandha Vijnana. And Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur has written this in one book called Prakrita Rasa Shatta Dushani. This one statement, Siddhanta Alasa Jana Anarta No Charina, that if one does not take pains to understand Siddhanta properly, then one will not be able to overcome one's anarthas. One will remain a conditioned soul. Those habits, those tendencies that we have acquired in our, what Prabhupada sometimes called psychophysical nature, the body and our mind, these habits and impure tendencies, they're called anarthas. And it's the whole effort of this sadhana bhakti process to overcome anarthas. So Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati said, unless one is taking pains, making determined effort to understand this Siddhanta in detail, so that we can see Krishna in everything. This is the point. There should be no corner of our either internal, mental, psychological experience or external perception of this world. There should be no area which is not flooded with Krishna consciousness. There should be no dark spots, because dark spots means ignorance, and ignorance means that's where anarthas will flourish. They will continue to flourish. They'll continue to grip us. So when Siddhanta Alasa means what? Lazy. Alasa means lazy. To be lazy in philosophy. So this is important. Everything in the Srimad Bhagavatam is, there's no, you know, technical department. Oh, some devotees, they like this technical stuff. We are bhaktas. We're going only for, what does Prabhupada say about that? They're going for the Rasa Lila, 10th canto, and thinking the rest is material. But they bring into their so-called study of Rasa Lila all their anarthas. And so the whole thing is spoiled. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati has also said, given one nice analogous statement, that if one brings a very nice professional expert orchestra, you know, music band plays very beautiful music, but brings that orchestra into the graveyard at night, in the middle of the night, and they play that beautiful music, who will dance? Only the ghosts. So the topic of Krishna's Rasa Lila, that is, yes, that is the highest topic as compared to the smiling face of the Lord. The Bhagavatam is measured out in that way according to the Lord's form. And the 10th canto is a smiling face. So the smiling face is, yes, it is the top, isn't it? So we're not saying it is not the topmost thing. But this is the comparison. You can bring that topmost subject matter like the orchestra. But if it is being heard and discussed in the graveyard, you see, it means an atmosphere that is predominated by tamo guna, then the so-called ecstasy will all be this ghostly business. You see, the ghosts, skeletons, that's horrible. So this is why we should not be lazy in Siddhanta, because by pursuing this philosophy, Krishna consciousness philosophy, pursuing it, to understand it threadbare, then jnana nirdhuta kalmasa, Krishna says in 5th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Tadatmanas tad buddhyas tad nishtas tad parayana. He's saying, give me your mind, atma, Srila Prabhupada is translated here, meaning mind or consciousness, buddhi, intelligence, nishta, your faith, and make me your only shelter. So one has to work. One has to work to do this, to accomplish this. And then by such effort, jnana nirhutta kalmasa, then jnana, transcendental knowledge will come. And the kalmasa, the dirty things of the heart, Prabhupada translates as misgivings. Now Maharaj is from England. I'm only from USA. England is the land of the English language. So correct me if I'm wrong. Misgivings, another way of saying misgivings is doubts, isn't it?
I was just thinking about this the other day, actually, when, sorry to interrupt you, when I was reading something else where Prabhupada said misgivings. And I don't have a dictionary in my computer at the moment, but it seems to me that misgiving, doubt, could be a more general term that applies to one could doubt without having a lack of trust. It could be like more intellectual, but misgiving seems to me to imply a lack of trust also.
So it's that
subtle difference.
Yeah. Right. It's that type of doubt that is arising from disbelief, in other words, from some fundamental rejection. Rather than just an inquiring doubt. I have one doubt, can you clear it? But this is not the type of doubt that is easily cleared because one has an attitude.
Right. And you can't convince someone that they want to be convinced.
So this is how Prabhupada translates this word kalmasha. Elsewhere we see kalmasha means contamination. Mm. Contamination of the heart. But what Prabhupada is indicating here is that the inner contaminants of the heart, they manifest in consciousness as these type of deep-rooted doubts that are very, very difficult to get rid of. In other words, it's the seeds of atheism are implanted in the mind. And so the way to get rid of them is to go into the heart and clean them there, but Krishna says, with knowledge. Gacchanti apunar avritam. He says, one must take the path of liberation. This is actually, to clarify that point I was making before and you were asking about it, I was saying, in so-called my philosophy, the measure I use is this vairagya, renunciation. And here we see Krishna referring to the same thing, that ganchati apunar avritam. One is to take the path of liberation away from the entanglements of this world. That should be one's direction. That should be one's intention. And with this intention, one should give, the Lord is saying, give me your mind, give me your intelligence, give me your faith, make me your refuge. With this intention of getting out of the material world. You see? Just like Srila Prabhupada, his title, Bhakti Vedanta. There is devotion, but Vedanta is the study of liberation. The anta, the conclusion of the Veda, is moksha. So Vedanta, famously, is that study, that subject matter that leads to liberation. So that is, when bhakti is combined with that, that's what we call shuddha bhakti, pure devotional service. It is not bhakti aimed at, increasing my material facilities. That's what mundane religion means. They're going to God, they believe in God, they have faith that there is God, and even that God is a person, and they do devotion, bhakti, and all these things. But their aim is, gimme, gimme, gimme. How about satirize the Durga Puja in Bengal, where they make these beautiful murtis, forms of Durga from straw and clay, and they paint them very nicely. And then for 9 days Prabhupada satirized the prayers they're making. You know the Bengali better than me.
It's Sanskrit. Dhanamdehi, Rupavati, Bharyadehi.
Sanskrit. So praying for money and praying for, Prabhupada said, praying for a woman. Yeah. Praying for material things. And then this means hetu. There is a cause to the bhakti. What is Bhagavatam says? Say? That pure devotional service is a haituki. And therefore, because it is haituki, it is also, the other side, not broken off at any point. You see? If there is a material cause, that means when that material desire has been provided for, then, like Prabhupada said, give us this day our daily bread, the Christians are praying. And when bread came, when they got sufficient material facility, they became atheistic. Now they have supermarkets to get their bread, and the churches are empty. Supermarkets are full, churches are empty. Prabhupada said, this is love of bread, not love of God. So, same thing we see in this Durga Puja. At the end of the 9 days, they have made their prayers for their materialistic wants and needs. And then Srila Prabhupada said, if you stand by the bank of the Ganga, you can see Mother Ganga taking so many Durga Murtis down to the Bay of Bengal, because they've just thrown them away. Puja finished, no more need. Throw her out. So this is not nitya seva. This is not regulated, unbroken, eternal devotional service. This is naimittika. This is simply for some convenience. Therefore, it is material. So anyway, yes, this is pure devotional service. One is aiming to get out of the cycle of birth and death, out of material entanglement. And in that way, one is approaching the Lord, and the Lord says, then I will bless that person with jnana, with transcendental knowledge. And the effect of that is nirdhutta, means to cleanse, kalmasha, the dirty things of the heart. Which again, Prabhupada translates in that verse as misgivings. So the purification of the heart results in the ridding of these intellectual obstacles, this in the form of sophisticated avidya. Avidya going in the disguise of some philosophical argument why I cannot surrender to Krishna. Yes, so again, this point. We should not be alasa, we should not be lazy in this understanding of philosophy. So as I said yesterday, there were just a few points I wanted to finish. So we had been talking about logic as the method or system of anuman, of inference or reason. And we said how the Charvakas, their praman, their evidence is simply based on the senses. And so whatever reasoning they have is totally superficial. It's thinking the body to be the self, therefore the logic is enjoy. Just enjoy, because when the body is gone, everything is finished. The Buddhists, they include anuman, actual intellectualism, in their system. So they have a much more developed process of knowledge, but it is voidistic. The greatest, considered to be the greatest Buddhist philosopher after Buddha. Actually, Lord Buddha himself did not really teach a philosophy. He actually taught a path of ethics. He was not very concerned with philosophy. As I said, there are points in his teachings which avyakrita, not to be talked about. But after him, because philosophy was needed, others came. So the foremost Buddhist philosopher was from down here. His name was Nagarjuna. He's from down here in South India. And he is the Acharya of Shunyavad. Shunyavad. We often say that Buddhism means Shunyavad, and that's true. But within Buddhism themselves, itself, they have Shunyavad is one department. And they have other philosophies. But actually, fundamentally, it is actually all Shunyavad. That's a fact. But Nagarjuna was the openly speaking Shunyavadi, saying that everything is empty. Actually, this sense of Shunya really means emptiness. Everything is empty of meaning. You may, in discussion with such, if you jump right away to saying, oh, Buddhism is voidism, a Buddhist may say, no. If you literally are trying to convince him that Buddhism is saying everything is one big zero, nothing, they may object to that. Although, logically, the logical consequence is that is what Buddhism really is. But what they do say is that there is this world, but it is empty of any meaning. It doesn't mean anything. It's just somehow going on. And what is going on is not at all important. So this is Shunyavad philosophy. So this is where the Buddhist logic ends up. Nagarjuna is considered to be the greatest Buddhist logician. And scholars, I have one book that Srila Prabhupada himself recommended. It's a book of philosophy written by two Bengali professors, last published in the 1960s. I have it on my computer. I got it from His Holiness Dhanadhar Maharaj when I was in Vrindavan. I photographed it, put it on my computer. The Prophet said, this book is very authorized. And so there these scholars are, they're pointing out how much Shankaracharya has borrowed from Nagarjuna, this voidistic logic. So, Vaishnavas, we have Pratyaksha Praman, evidence of the senses. We have Anuman, evidence of logic also. But as we're explaining again and again, foremost, first and foremost, is Shabda Praman. Then there are others who even go further. This is what I wanted to. They add Pramans. And unnecessarily. Like the Nyayis, the logicians. The logicians, actually, their main praman is also anuman, reasoning. And so they want to build up this reasoning and expand it into more and more pramans, more and more apparent evidences. And so one of their pramans is called artavati, which means similarity. So the example is, you may have heard of this animal called Nilgai. You see around Vrindavan. When we were last on Govardhan Parikram, a whole herd came out of the forest. They're very rare to see. But we saw a whole herd of this Nilgai. So Nilgai, what is it? It is, to help you understand, it is called blue cow. I think that's what Nilgai means, blue cow. So this is Artavati. It gives you an idea by similarity. It's not a cow and it's not blue. But this helps you understand what it is. If you're getting any understanding, thinking of a blue cow, that's not exactly what a Nilgai is, if you think like that. A Jersey cow painted blue. That will not really give you the accurate image of a Nilgai. But it is a way to help us understand. So the Nyayis, they make this into a separate praman. And that's for the sake of word juggling. Actually, it just belongs to Anuman. It's just another form of Anuman. So you can see in this that Vaishnavas, we use Anuman, but we don't put excessive value on it. Because our ultimate praman, Prabhupada, and I told you, Prabhupada said, really, we have only one praman, and that's Shabda. So the Nyayis, and another is Artapati. That was Artavati. Then they have Artapati. Prabhupada humorously used this in talking about his sister. You know? he was joking with his disciples that my sister is so fat. And she says she doesn't eat. She eats very little. So that means she must eat at night. So this is Artapati. This is another technique of the Nyayis. So it's a kind of, you know, around the back type of logic. You see, you don't see something, but you fill in the gap with some logical explanation. So the Nyayis, you can see their process from this. That becomes a praman. It's just a guess. You see, a person may be fat because they have a thyroid disease. You know, and it may be true that they only eat very little. There's some other reason why they're fat. But the Nyayis fill it in with some explanation, and it becomes a praman. You see, that guess becomes it's an evidence. You see, so this is unnecessary. It all belongs to Anuman. Then the Mayavadis, they have a praman called abhav, which means non-existence, and this is what they got from this Nagarjuna. So the way of this abhav logic works is for example, one has a water pot in one's room, and one goes out and comes back and sees the water pot is gone. Water pot is not there anymore. So then one hypothesizes an explanation for that. That my servant has come in and removed the water pot. Again, this was not seen. But this is a way of explaining the non-existence of the water pot. Mm-hmm. So anyway, abhav. This becomes a praman in the Mayavadi philosophy. Big explanations for why there is nothing. In other words, that's their conclusion. This is not real, but there's an explanation for it. And modern scientists do this too. Modern scientists, they have this Big Bang theory. And they say everything exploded out of a primordial void state. It was some primordial state of nothingness, and everything exploded out of it. And so now there is all this universe. But yeah, but you see, obviously that doesn't make sense. So then they have to explain this void, and then their explanation of the void with, you know, what they call virtual potential energies in it. It becomes a very complex thing. It becomes something. So this is typical bogus word juggling. You see, they're trying to pull a rabbit out of a hat. They're saying everything comes. They're saying their bottom line is everything came out of nothing. And then you say, how can that be? Well, you see, this nothing is very complicated. There are many things you have to know about this nothing. You have to, you know, it takes 12 years in university to understand this nothing. You need degrees in astrophysics and quantum physics and this, and then you'll understand it. And then you can know what we're saying. Then you say, so that means the nothing is something? No. The nothing is nothing, but you can't understand. And that's what the Mayavadis do. Yes. And that's all the Mayavadis are doing. And therefore, Prabhupada said, just word juggling. Just word juggling. So, yeah, so that was one thing I wanted to finish up about logic. And so now we are going to go into the next phase of this seminar, which, as I indicated, we called it Vedic psychology. I have given seminars on Vedic psychology. Here in terms of this seminar, we're not going to be so much concerned with the psychology in the sense of how the mind is working and how we get problems and all these things and how to solve them. But Vedic psychology is concomitant, it is inseparable from the philosophy of creation. Because there is this principle, which Prabhupada explains in a purport in the Bhagavatam, of Vyasti Samasti and Mahasamasti, Prabhupada says also. Mahavishnu is Mahasamasti. But Vyasti Samasti. So this universe is Samasti, the totality. And what is this universe? What is this Vishwa? What is this Jagat? It is, as Ramanujacharya says, and Srila Prabhupada acknowledges the veracity of this explanation, that this universe is the, so to say, the material body of God. Not that he is conditioned by that material body as we are conditioned by ours, but it is a personal yet physical display of the Lord's energies, creative energies. So in that universal form, that samasti embodiment, there is everything. There is mind, there are the senses, everything is there. And in Western philosophy you have this Jung, Carl Jung, and he was very much speaking of this, what he called archetype. So this comes in here. The idea of archetype is that in our human affairs, we're following a pattern that is somehow cosmic, somehow universal. Jung didn't really explain how it is, because obviously he doesn't have Vedic knowledge, but this was his insight, that there are some themes, some universal themes, and they crop up again in human behavior. So this is made very clear in the Bhagavatam. It is explained directly by Srila Prabhupada in a purport with these terms, Vyasti Samasti. We are Vyasti. Vyasti, like Vyasadeva, Vyasadeva. So this word Vyas means to divide or separate. So we are separate. In the Vedas there's this term, Chudra Brahmanda. Chudra Brahmanda means little universe. Every human being is a little universe. Means we are a little replica of the universal form. Whatever is there in the universal form is in very small measure in us. But because we, Jivatma, are also very, very small, therefore we are conditioned, we are consciousness is polluted and diverted by this little body that we have. So this is what we'll be looking at when I'm using this term Vedic psychology. We're going to look at the principles of this material covering of the soul. And as I will hope to be able to explain to you today, if there's time enough, the main principle of the covering is the mind. You cited that verse the other day, karmatmaka, shiravanda, it ends in that line. Anyway, this is the end of it, karmatmaka, shiravanda. That because the mind is full of karmas, atmika, the mind, is dwelling on karma, material activity. Therefore, sharirabandha. Therefore, we have to take bodies. You see? So, it's not, this is very important, it's not that karma is simply, some mechanical principle of action and reaction, and somehow we are trapped in it like, I don't know if you've ever seen this Charlie Chaplin film called Modern Times. And he's working in a factory, there are these big gears turning, and he's operating some lever on the gears, and then he gets caught in the gears, and you see him he's being drawn through the gears of the machine. So this would be a kind of gross and misleading way to understand karma. That we are just caught in some machinery. But actually, we are caught in karma because of our desire. And that desire is here in the mind. The mind keeps dwelling on material activities, and that's why we are undergoing karma. So if that conditioned state of the mind can be corrected, then karma will stop. It's not that one goes on suffering karma. You see, on and on and on, after the mind has become freed from material obsessions. Sometimes devotees are asking like that. You see, they're talking like that. Something happens and they say, it's my karma. But no, actually, if one has taken to Krishna consciousness, one has taken to this process of purifying the mind, there may be some residual karma, but you have to understand everything is happening under the direction of the Lord for the purpose of our spiritual advancement. So it's not that we're caught in some blind mechanism that's just drawing us onward and onward, and we're struggling, help, help, how do I get out? And it keeps sucking us onward and onward and onward. If that's happening to us, it's because we want it to happen. That's the point. It's because of the state of our mind. And when that state changes from material consciousness to Krishna consciousness, then this body will continue on. This is called Parabdha Karma. But then when this body is finished, that's the end of it. Baladev Vidyabhushan in his Govinda Bhasya gives this nice example of a singed cloth. Or we see this also with newspaper, you know?
Singed cloth. It's one of the nyans, actually.
When a cloth is... When a cloth is brought close to a flame, then it doesn't overtly burn up, but its substance becomes so affected by the flame that you just have to slightly touch it. It has become deteriorated by the flame, so you just touch it and it falls apart. You can see this with newspaper. Maybe this is an easier example. You see, if a wadded up newspaper, if you burn it, that the ash will remain in that shape. You see? It'll look like a black wadded up newspaper. And then if you just touch it, it falls apart. So this is the explanation of a devotee's parabdha karma. If a devotee becomes Krishna conscious, then yes, his body is there to the end of the life, but it is like a burned newspaper. That means when death comes is, you know, to touch that, death comes to touch that body, and then the whole thing just falls apart. And no more karma, no more, no next birth. So anyway, this is why we'll be looking at this Vedic psychology to understand. What we're trying to understand here is how the soul has become implicated in this material world and how to get out. And that is what philosophy is all about. In the West, they say philosophy is the attempt to use the mind to rise above the mind. Now, that is a contradiction. But there's still some truth in it. You see? We are also in Krishna consciousness using the mind. As I told you, citing Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, he says, tad buddhyas tad atmanas, tad atmanas means the mind. He says use the mind. But he is giving the method in Bhagavad Gita, and the method is given in Srimad Bhagavatam, by which we can rise above the mind by using the mind. Because the mind is what? The mind is simply polluted consciousness, and consciousness is the energy of the soul. You see? So when consciousness can shake off the contamination of the three modes of nature, then that is clear consciousness. That is Krishna consciousness. So this is again why philosophy is so important. Philosophy guided by Vedic knowledge. We use the mind to shake off the influence of the modes of nature. So, now, to introduce this subject of Vedic psychology, which, as I said, is referring to the process of creation taught in the Srimad Bhagavatam, I want to go to something that Yogendra Prabhu brought up. You were asking about these causes. Mm-hmm. So this I thought this is a good point of entry. So in Greek philosophy, Aristotle's philosophy, there is what in the Greek language is called aitia, which means reasons for something happening, or in other words, in simple language, cause. An aitia is a reason why something happens. And so Aristotle, he famously proposed four reasons, four aitia, four causes. And these are the material cause, the formal cause, the efficient cause, and the final cause. Now I'm going to explain these. It's very simple, once you hear the explanation. Let's start with an example, a house. Here we're in a house. Okay? Here we are in a house. So, the material cause of this house, that means the ingredients, you know, the stuff out of which this house is made. If we want to talk about how this house came into being, we cannot ignore the bricks, we cannot ignore the timbers or girders or whatever else. We cannot ignore the wood and the glass and the metal and all these things that make up this house. That is certainly a major part of understanding how this house came into being. But that's only one part, and that's called the material cause. Or Srila Prabhupada, as I said, he also sometimes uses the term ingredient cause. So this is one. Then, the formal cause. Formal cause means the design. If you want to talk about how a house came into being, then we have to consider the design. That there was an architect. And he designed this house. There was a what they call a blueprint that the builders followed. And then mentioning the builders, that brings us to the third cause. That's the efficient cause. The effective cause. Some person or persons got together and working together they created the effect of this house. They put together the bricks, etc., according to the design. And then there's the final cause. The final cause means the purpose. What is the reason for this house? So we can see this house, it's very evident to us that this house was not designed to be a temple. This was designed for people to live in, I guess, apartment house. That's what it looks like to me. Next door, you have the Vidya Hospital. That's also a house or a building. But that was designed for a different purpose, a hospital. So therefore you go inside. You know, even if you removed all the hospital, but it wouldn't be a place where you'd want to live. Such big rooms, you see, long, the wards, you see, who would want to live in such a place? And so, that is the final cause, the purpose, the reason why something has been made, constructed, created. So, these four ideas, these four aspects of causation have since the time of Aristotle dominated Western philosophy, and they come up again and again and again and again. So one may wonder, so is there some equivalent in Indian philosophy, Vedic philosophy? And the answer is yes, and the Vedic explanation of causation goes beyond these four. So you can investigate this yourself. I ask you in your spare time to look at Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter 9, Verse 42. And there you will find these four causes that I've just explained from Aristotle, and more are listed, including Vinodasya, that everything has come about by the Lord's pleasure. Vinod means the Lord's happiness. So Vedanta Sutra also says the ultimate explanation of creation is that this is a lila of the Lord. This is His lila. So this is something totally incomprehensible to Western philosophy. They would never be able to understand that. So if you look at this verse, it's a very long verse, and it's giving many different aspects of causation, including these four. So the ingredient or material cause is called upadana in this verse. The formal cause is called svarupena pradana rupena. This phrase is used. You can understand it right from the Sanskrit. Svarupena means the Lord's own form. The Lord's own transcendental form, pradana rupena, is giving form to the pradana, to the, you know, the pradana means the unmanifest material nature. When material nature is manifest in gunas, it is called prakriti. In Gita, this term, guna prakriti. And in Gita 14th chapter, the pradana is called Mahabrahman. Mahabrahman. So pradana and Brahman, they're also synonyms. Not Brahman in the sense of Brahma Jyoti, exactly. But, as I said this morning, Yasya Prabha Prabhavato Jagananda Koti, from out of the Jyoti is coming these universes. And Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad and other Upanishads are explaining this. Srila Prabhupada in a translation of Brahma Samhita verse, this... Karnarnava Jaleva Jatismi Yogam Nijamananta Jagananda Suramakuma Ahada Shaktim Avalamba Param Samurtim. That verse in Brahma Sangita. So Srila Prabhupada, he explains there, and this is all how Srila Prabhupada translates this verse, I found in my research, is very much, I don't like to say backed up, because Prabhupada doesn't need to be backed up, but if you want verification of this, it's not in the standard Brahma Samhita translation, it's in a Bhagavatam purport. But Srila Prabhupada in the translation, he says that the universes are kept in potential within the pores of Mahavishnu. The universes are kept in potential as seeds, potential seeds within the pores of Mahavishnu. And then when he breathes out, they come out and they expand. And so this is also mentioned in indicated in Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad and several other Upanishads. They say that the beginning, the Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad, which as I told you, is the favorite Upanishad of the Mayavadis. This is the one they say, this is where you get the real Advaita philosophy. But in this Upanishad, there is a statement that the beginning of this universe, or the origin of this universe, is what? Is Purusha, is a person. So that doesn't go very well with Mayavadi philosophy. That before there was this universe, there was a person. And that is Mahavishnu. So the universe exists within Mahavishnu as a seed of potential. It is unmanifest. It is unmanifest in that state. Just the potential seed is there. And then when he breathes out, then it manifests. So this is what I'm explaining here is svarupena pradan rupena. So that unmanifested state is called pradan. That means it is material energy, but in that energy there is nothing to be seen, nothing to be heard, nothing to be smelled, tasted, or felt. Nothing is presented to the senses in this state of material energy. In the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Shukadeva Goswami speaking of this pradhan, he describes it as shunyavat. It is like a void. Shunyavat means, he's not saying it is a void, but he's saying it is like. The experience of pradhan is the experience of voidness. So, the rup, the form that appears within pradhan as prakriti, guna prakriti, that form is originating in Swarupa, the transcendental form of the Lord. So, the material form is, one can say, the shadow, Srila Prabhupada uses, the shadow of the substantial form of Krishna. A shadow cast on the unmanifest material nature. And that shadow, then, it has, yes, it is form. So, svarupena, pradanrupena, the formal cause. Then, nimitya yamana. This is the efficient cause, or the assembling cause, the working cause, like the workers who built this house. And then finally, artya vishesha, means the special necessity or purpose or reason, the final cause. You see, there is a reason why this universe was created. There is a reason why we exist right now. This is called artya vishesha. Each one of us is here for a reason.
The reason is to become Krishna conscious.
And that reason is given by the Lord. So, what I want to do is draw your attention to these fourfold causes, which, as I said, are so important in the West. I'd like to just draw your attention. This may be, I'll admit, this may be, there's a bit of anuman in this. Not really, because everything, all causes, this is what the Bhagavatam says, all causes and effects are generated from the Lord only anyway. So what I'm saying is, what I'm about to tell you, it is not a groundless speculation. But I hope that you'll find this interesting, that this fourfold causation can be related to the Chaturvyuha. There are, in this process of creation described in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is actually the appearance, one after the other, of four forms of the Lord, four expansions of Krishna. So, Vasudev, then Sankarshan, then Pradumna, then Aniruddha. So, Vasudev is Mahanarayan, and Mahanarayan exists in the Vaikuntha state, and the jivas who are with him then, they are in the liberated state. But he expands. Sankarshan means Mahavishnu. So then Mahavishnu, this is where the process of creation begins, with Mahavishnu. And Mahavishnu, or Sankarshan, expands further, Pradumna, Garbhadakshay Vishnu. Then, further expansion, Aniruddha, Chirodakshay Vishnu. And I'll be explaining in the days to come, each of these expansions is the marker of a stage of creation. Yes? Come in. Join us. The business of the material world does not stop for philosophy. Philosophy is preparing oneself to deal with this world without being pulled down in one's consciousness. So, Vasudev, we can understand, I'm trying to help you understand, is the ultimate giver of this artya vishesha, because he is the beginning point of the process of creation. Vasudev desired to create, Bahusham in the Vedic language. He desired to become many. So he desired that the living entities be manifest and be active. Again, ultimately for the purpose of reviving their Krishna consciousness. So we see in Vasudeva the Artha Vishesha, the final cause of everything. Then Sankarsana, formal cause. Or Mahavishnu, formal cause. From him, the universes emanate and begin to take shape. And then Pradumna or Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, material cause, ingredient cause. Garbhadakshaya Vishnu or Pradumna is the lord of the Mahatattva. And in the Mahatattva, I explained in the TV talk yesterday, Shodashakal 16, Srila Prabhupada says Lord Krishna has a name. This was in a lecture he gave here in India. Gokarna, maybe it was. No?
How about was it, Gokarna?
Or Gokali?
Gorakhpur.
Gorakhpur, that's it. Jang Maharaj, Gorakhpur. So in one lecture in Gorakhpur, he said Krishna's one name is Shodashakal Purna. So the Shodashakal, this is what, you know, this is, you find this again, and you find so many verses in the Bhagavatam about these 16 ingredients of creation. It's in the Upanishad, in which Chandogya Upanishad, there's a whole section, chapter called Shodashakal Vidya. So this is five karmendriyas, five jnanendriyas, five mahabhutas, or the objects of the senses. This is 15, and then there's the mind, which also includes buddhi and ahamkara, the subtle body, in other words. So these are the ingredients. As I said, these ingredients are within us, but they manifest in the Mahatattva, the Shodashakal. And Krishna is Shodashakal Purna. And so that means everything ultimately begins with him. He has his transcendental senses, his transcendental mind. Satchitananda Vigraha. And that is the, to use that fancy word, archetype of everything else that follows. So this Shodashakal manifests in the Mahatattva. And so Garbhadakshaya Vishnu presides over the Mahatattva. So that is the ingredient cause. These 16 items are the ingredients of our body, the creation, the universe. And then Aniruddha or Chirudakshaya Vishnu, super soul, efficient cause. Because Paramatma, super soul in this universe, he is the Lord, but he's appearing as the chief of the devatas. He's the head of all the devatas, and the devatas are his angas. And the devatas are the efficient cause of this creation. By their work, their activity, everything comes into being. So the devatas are the amsas of the Paramatma, the super soul. So, now I don't want you to misunderstand this explanation that I'm giving. We were saying in lunch earlier, quid pro quo, that these exactly match up and there's no other, because we're talking of Krishna and everything has its origin in Krishna. So, if I say Vasudeva is Artha Vishesha, that is not to say that Sankarsana and Pradumna are not also the cause of Artha Vishesha or anything else. But this is just to help us understand. We should not fall into this. This is a particular feature of Western mentality, actually, to be very rigid in one's thinking. You see? This is my conclusion, having compared Western philosophy with Vedic philosophy, and even Western mentality with Indian mentality. The Indian mentality is much more, there's a word, supple, or agile, or adjustable. You see it on the roads. You see the traffic on the roads. So, in the West, there's this rule in America and Western Europe that you should drive on the right. And that's a rule. And if you break that, you're a lawbreaker. Police will pull you over. In Great Britain, the same rigidity is there, but it's dried on the left. Am I right?
Yeah.
No, Sweden, they've changed. It's all changed. Western Europe is all drive on the right, like in America. So, but in India, it's both. When the two cars coming are far away from each other, then they drive on the right. But when they approach each other, then they drive on the left and pass. Of course, that's a joke, but Indian mind is very adaptable.
It's a very important word in every Indian language, in Hindi, in Bengali, in Gujarati, kind of adjust. Borrowed from English. It's very important.
Adjust.
I'm not just for English.
So in understanding our philosophy, this is also important. One should have an agile, adjustable mind. The Western philosophy, you know, this is what they say, Western scholars who have made an effort to understand Bhagavad Gita, very often you find they dismiss it, saying it's full of contradictions. In one place he's saying this, in another place he's saying that, and it's opposite. And so it's a Western effort to keep everything in rigid categories, you see. Drive on the right, you see. In India you're driving both left and right. So this is intelligence. We're coming from the West, we often astonished and wondering how it works, but it works, especially when we're sitting in the bus watching another car coming from but somehow it works. So that's important. I'm just trying to help you understand how these four causes, which Yogindra Prabhu was bringing up, they are already there in Bhagavata philosophy, and we can see their origin in these expansions of the Lord in his pastimes of creation. So ultimately these causes mean the Lord himself, the Lord's different activities in his lila of creation. This is what I want to get you to understand. I don't want to you to start thinking in some rigid ways, categorical ways, but just understand this point. So, again, I think we've covered a lot. We have today made an introduction into the process of creation presented in the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is very essential to our philosophy because it lets us understand what our present condition is, very scientifically. You see, we can understand where we are and how we have gotten here and how we can get out. So we're going to be going into that in rather exacting detail in the days to come, because I feel this is very, very important for us to understand. And then we can really understand, you see, then you can really understand, once you grasp this, this inner logic of the whole bhakti process. Everything we do in devotional service is wonderfully logical. It's not just a bunch of, you know, weird ritual. Like this, I was saying, first time I came to the temple, I didn't understand well, so it was all very strange to me. And of course, one can get into it, especially if one's a hippie. One can get into it. Why not? Why not dance around the plant? You know? Why not jump around in front of some god with big eyes? Why not? It's far out. And so there are many who just leave it at that. It's far out, it's fun. We just jump around and dance and bow down when, you know, the plant comes out. And but, you know, this is not a deep understanding. And again, referring back to how we started this class, Siddhanta Alasa, if we are lazy about understanding the true significance of the activities of devotional service, then we will become captured by this sahajya contamination. Sahajya means one who takes it cheaply. Yeah, it's just fun. It's just, you know, just do it, it's cool, and not knowing why. because there is this big blank space, why we're doing this, it can become filled with maya. A polluted and perverted explanation of everything. And that's what these apa sampradayas, these sahajya sampradayas are all about. They're doing many of the same things we do. They chant Hare Krishna, names of the Lord. They play Mridanga, they wear Kantimala. They have temples. All this, externally at least, it's very similar. But when you look at the reasons for why they're doing what they're doing, well, you don't want to look at those reasons. They're horrible. They're very disgusting. So, you see, Maya never sleeps. They say, rust never sleeps. You know? There's this expression, rust. You know, metal, exposed metal, it will rust. Rust will collect on it if you're not very, very attentive. And so similarly, if we are not very, very careful to keep our consciousness pure and clean, keep dusting the mirror of the mind, and that is by chanting without offense, and that is why we have this philosophy. The philosophy is there so that we can remove, we heard it, the anarthas. If we chant maintaining anarthas, that's called apara. And that type of chanting, then it will not permit us to overcome our conditioning. Maybe after a long, long, long time, but the effect is very much reduced. So, one has to take effort to keep the mind free of the dust of material conditioning and wrong ideas and all this, so that one can chant Hare Krishna purely. So this is why we're going to spend so much time looking into the details of this creation to see what mistake we made to end up as we have ended up here in this material body, and how to correct that mistake by this bhakti process. This bhakti process is correcting that age-old mistake. So we have to know this. Otherwise, we're just doing blindly. Then we won't know how to... You see, we won't be thinking like that. I'm correcting a mistake. And we may go on making the same mistake, even dressed as devotees. All right, then. Time?
11:20.
Okay. So, I think it's a good time to open for questions. Yes?
Your lectures that you sometimes you mention that even there is the fifth pose, and you name it like the distant pose, but you didn't mention this time
remote cause,
yes, like that. So you didn't mention that this time, so.
Yeah, well, I'm because I'm talking about Aristotle and his four classical aspects of causation. So remote cause, yes, that's Krishna. Remote cause means sarva karana karanam, that he's the cause of all causes. And he's the cause of all causes simply by his being Krishna. He doesn't have to do anything except just be Krishna. And by being Krishna, everything else, because parasya shakti or vividhaya shriyate, because he is Krishna, all the shaktis, all the energies, they serve him by their own svabhava, by their own nature. This is the statement of the Upanishad. So that's remote cause. These other causes are, you know, you can say involved causes. They're involved, they're somehow active. Let me see, but Krishna's aloof. He's remote, he's removed, but he's the cause of all causes.
comment just now you were saying about how Westerners, they have a very rigid approach to life and philosophy. When Western scholars read Bhagavad Gita, they often reject it as contradictory. In Bhagavad Gita, according to many even Vaishnava commentators, Krishna is speaking in different parts of Bhagavad Gita. He's addressing different types of people. So there are different, almost different philosophies or different rules for different types of people. But the Western mentality is to say that it's all one and everyone's equal and there's no difference. And it's wrong that there should be Brahmin, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, because everyone should be treated the same, whereas the Vedic system is much more realistic, actually, that there are differences,
yes.
And people should be instructed accordingly, and even their outlook on life may be different, and they should be engaged differently. This is I feel that this lack of understanding of this point is causing so many problems in our society today, where they're trying to make the material platform everyone equal, which they're not.
Yes.
It's a kind of foolish Mayavan.
Yeah, and this is rigidity. Mm. This is rigidity. This is dogmatism. You see, equality is an ideal. Just like truth, beauty, justice, peace, these are all ideals. And in this world, this non-ideal world, these ideals are not evidently manifest. You see? Like, you look at human society. Is there peace? Everyone wants peace, but is there peace? Is there really tangible peace? No. You see? And that's the way things are in this world. Yet, peace remains an ideal. And so, the more intelligent, from our point of view, as students of Srila Prabhupada, hearing Srila Prabhupada's own explanation of philosophy and his own comments on Western philosophy, the more intelligent philosophers like Socrates and Plato, they propose that there is an ideal realm, a realm beyond this world, and that our effort in cultivation of knowledge and pursuit of the truth should be aimed at attaining that ideal realm. And this is a, you know, Platonic philosophy. It's a kind of mysticism where one ultimately should become detached from this world and liberated into this. It's not very clear, obviously, but Prabhupada appreciated that, you know, the general trend of thinking is positive. It's going in the direction of Vaishnava philosophy. So Srila Prabhupada, he even said that Socrates was a mukta, a siddha mukta, a perfected liberated soul.
So
because he was given poison and he said yes. And they asked him, so how do you want to be buried? And he very, in a slyly transcendental way, said, you can bury me or you can grave me if you can catch me. Meaning that he knew that he's spirit soul. So he didn't mind to drink the poison and give up this body. So Prabhupada appreciated these philosophers. But you see, what has happened with the advance of Kali Yuga, which means the grossening of everything, including thought processes, is that there's no more distinction between this, you know, mundane level and the ideal level. They become muddled together and in a rigid dogmatic fashion. And maybe we'll have time to go into that in detail in these days, I don't know. But one can actually trace this out in the so-called progress of Western philosophy, this happening. And so actually what it is, it's residual religious dogmatism. There was a dogmatism before, when the Western world was more religious, which resulted, as I told you, I explained, just indicated yesterday, that's why philosophy came up and became more or less anti-religious or questioning the religious assumptions because of that dogmatism. But that rigid thinking, this is a product of tamoguna. Tamas means very heavy, you know, very heavy, very thick, very difficult to move, like an elephant, you know? If an elephant doesn't want to move, how are you going to, you know, like push on his backside? If he doesn't want to move, he won't move. So this is the so-called, this is the real progress of Kali Yuga. This thing is becoming heavier, thicker, more, you know, concrete ballast, you see, weighed down. So, this dogmatism remains. Now it's, they want to realize the ideals which are actually spiritual in the Sri Chaitanya Shikshamrita. Bhaktivinoda Thakur is talking about the, there are, what does he call them? Swarup? Anyway, the qualities of the soul, which are swarup, which belongs to the soul. And there's seven of them.
Swarup Lakshana.
Swarup Lakshana, yeah. And these seven are the classical ideals, actually. Mm. Like one is Nyaya, justice, another is Maitri, friendliness between living entities, and loving kindness, and Daya, mercy. But these are all ideals, and he says they belong to the soul. But in Western philosophy and culture, they want these ideals to manifest within this mundane existence. In other words, in the bodily, you know, in this gross bodily concept, we should realize peace and we should realize love and we should realize... And it's just not possible. But they insist that it will happen, armed with some doctrine of, you know, communism or some other socialism, egalitarianism, you know, we the peopleism. We will realize that everyone is equal and, you know, everyone is beautiful.
They're trying to legislate.
And it's insanity, actually. It's madness. I mean, you really, when you think about it, when I think about it, my mind boggles. It's absurd. It's crazy. But they insist on this. So, anyway, like you say, this is even seen in our movement to some degree. We're advocates of such kinds of ideas. But because they're attached to Maya, how else can we say it? Therefore, you know, sooner or later the crunch will come. They have to make the choice. You either go this way with Krishna consciousness or that way. Because you're not going to be able to satisfy this mundane, dogmatic way of thinking that everyone will be equal. You'll not be able to realize that here in Krishna consciousness. It can be realized in the ideal realm of Krishna consciousness, in the absolute realm. Yes, we are working to realize those ideals in the spiritual realm. But they cannot be realized here.
Even in the spiritual world, although everyone is has equal opportunity to serve Krishna and enjoys equally with Krishna, but still there's gradation.
Yes, that's true. but Srila Prabhupada said, you know, the difference is this is a good point that Maharaj has brought up, because the difference is, while yes, there are gradations in the spiritual, but Srila Prabhupada said that those devotees, those liberated devotees, in whatever position they are fully satisfied. That's the point. Therefore, they're not agitated that I have to, you know, I'm only a friend of Krishna. I must become a gopi. And therefore, you know, going out and parading in front of Krishna's house with signs, we want to be gopis. We want to be gopis. Give us our rights.
Yeah,
satisfied. And that's the problem. Here in the material world, nobody is satisfied. That's the meaning of the material world. Nobody here is satisfied. Everyone's agitated, disturbed. Whatever they've got, they want something else. And that's why they'll never realize what, you know, these ideals of equality, because they're never satisfied. That's why. Whatever happens, like they, you know, there's this joke from Eastern Europe to illustrate this. There were two poor serfs, that means servants who worked the land for some landholder. Very poor, and their life is a great struggle. But one of them, he was very religious, so he was praying and doing devotions and keeping the picture of Jesus and always bowing down and reading the Bible. So after some 40 days of this observance, then this man got a cow. The landowner, whoever, gifted him with a cow. And so he could have milk, and his position improved very much. So his next door neighbor, the other poor man, saw this. So then he got a picture of Jesus, and he began to bow down and pray and read the Bible. And 40 days went by, and Jesus appeared to him. And Jesus very nicely said, "No, my dear faithful man, I think I know why you have called me here. Your neighbor received a cow by my grace, so you must also want a cow." And this poor man said, "No, just make his cow die." Yes. This is the thing. Nobody satisfied, because what is the principle of this material world? Envy. This is the foundational principle of material world. So how even everyone gets everything on their list, you see, of demands. After marching in the street so many days, they get everything, they'll still not be satisfied.
If I'm not wrong, in Chaitanya-charitamrita, at one place, there is even in the rasas, there is they move, devotees move from one rasa to another. Is it something like that there?
Something like that may be there, but that is not something to think about so much now. There are indications of that, but personally, I never feel very inspired to go into these things. Like Prabhupada said, you know, all these kind of questions. He said, first you get there, and then you'll know these things. Right now we are here in the material world. So it is not very useful for us to be contemplating such things. Change of rasa when we ourselves have no rasa at all.
I was trying to refer to the point that because we are not satisfied here, we are trying to move up. But in the spiritual world, whichever platform we are satisfied, so there we don't need to move up.
Yes. But, you know, this type of, I don't know exactly what you're trying to get at, but it shouldn't be a strategy for introducing the idea that there's also dissatisfaction in the spiritual world, therefore they are changing. It's not the point. Everyone is satisfied. If there is a change of rasa, that is for the opportunity of serving Krishna. You see? Because actually, why are they there in the spiritual world? To serve Krishna. That's the aim. So there is one, just to illustrate, there is in one account we find that Krishna was playing with his cowherd boys and he desired to take bath, but Jamuna was far away. So one of his friends took the form of river and Krishna bathed in the river. And then when Krishna came out of the river, he had to dry himself, so the same cowherd boy took the form of a towel, and Krishna. So I mean, for the case of devotional service, one may change one's rasa, particularly in Goloka Vrindavan. But before we go into these things,
we should be working, you know, to get our own rasa clarified. That will take all of our attention. Yes.
In the Bhagavatam, the mind is described as the product of the mode of goodness, whereas the intelligence is the product of the mode of passion. But if you say that the mind has to be controlled by the mind has to be by intelligence, so it's like mind is more crazy, but you describe it as the product of the mode of goodness, whereas intelligence is.
You see, there are different, there are higher orders in which these modes are manifest. This is something that we'll be going into, but just briefly, the whole creation actually begins from the mode of ignorance. You see, Mahavishnu is lying in yoga nidra, and all the living entities are lying in, not in yoga nidra, they're just lying in nidra, in tamo guna. Susupti, there's no consciousness at all. And so that's the starting point. And there is where Lord Shiva is. Lord Shiva, Srila Prabhupada says, is actually a feature of Mahavishnu. So Lord Shiva is Mahadev. Mahadev, of all the demigods, he is the greatest, presiding over the whole creation. This, you see, this is the highest order of the tamo guna. So this is where Lord Shiva is. This is not to be compared to a drunkard lying in a gutter here in Salem. We should not think, that's tamo guna, this is tamo guna. That's a higher order, you understand? In the process of creation. Then the next stage is the raju guna. And this is the manifestation of Mahatattva. This is the creative impulse from which the ingredients of the universe appear. And then out of that, Garbhadakshya Vishnu, comes Lord Brahma, who is the Rajaguna avatar. So that, and then what follows is the Aniruddha or Super Soul manifestation. And as Super Soul is entering into the living entity, Brahma is giving them bodies. And simultaneously, the Lord is entering into their hearts as Paramatma, and the mind is manifesting. So, you see, this passion out of which intelligence manifests is a higher order. It's an earlier phase of creation. That intelligence is actually the Vedic knowledge given by Brahma. So, then we have this mind, which, yes, is in the mode of goodness. It's in the mode of goodness. But the mind must be directed, because the mind is just there to receive the impressions of the senses. And the senses are in the lower mode of passion. You understand? The senses are in a mode of passion lower than the mind. And then the senses are plugged into sense objects, which are in the mode of ignorance, which is the lowest feature of the mode of ignorance. So that means the mind is in danger of being dragged away by passion and ignorance. There's lower versions of passion and ignorance. So then above the mind, there is this higher order of Rajoguna manifest as knowledge. The Vedic knowledge by which we heard this morning. There's Brahma Tejas, which is the power of Brahman itself. And in this material world, for the regulation of this world, it becomes the higher order of Rajaguna. So this sense of Rajaguna is that it is giving direction. Just like a king. A king is considered to be in the mode of passion. But it's not the same kind of mode of passion as some knucklehead you see running around on the street trying to satisfy his senses. You can't compare the two. The king has real authority and real knowledge how to rule, and that is Vedic knowledge. So similarly, the intelligence is supposed to rule over the mind. And then One is actually brought up to this highest stage of the tamoguna. Can you believe it? This is all explained in the Vedanta literature. And that's the stage called pragya. Pragya. Because this is the stage in which the consciousness is complete. In other words, all the awareness of material activities has shut down. You see, this is like you see Lord Shiva in meditation. So he's totally closed off from the form, features, activities of this material world. Totally absorbed within himself, meditating on Super Soul. So this is, you see, in a higher sense, the tamas. You see, the tamas also means inertia, no activity. And this is the stage prior to liberation, when all material activity stops. This is also a kind of tamas, but of a higher order. I hope that's clear.
So there are manifestations of the modes on different levels.
Yes, exactly.
This makes the picture clear. Right?
Yes.
So we just by our rigid mentality, want to put it.
That's a good point.
Into classifications.
Of course, you know, and then when we talk of intelligence, there are different kinds of intelligence, different kinds of buddhi. So buddhi can be without Vedic knowledge. There's papa buddhi, for example. There's an intelligence that just for manufacturing sinful activities. Like, you know, we were talking the other day about monks making wine and beer. That required intelligence. You know, slaughterhouse. There's a design, there's a plan, there's intelligence behind the slaughterhouse. But this is papa buddhi. So this is degrading intelligence. And this is intelligence which is also captivated by the actual lower modes. You see, it is simply aimed at gratifying the senses. So it's dragged away. Yes?
Maharaj, in the course of the class, a few times you mentioned that Buddhism actually isn't a philosophy. And I completely do not understand that. Could you please explain when the system of thought may be called a philosophy?
Well, going back to the original meaning of the word philosophy, so Sophia, wisdom, wisdom of the soul, knowledge of the soul, insight of the soul, which leads to liberation of the soul. Philosophia, love of that knowledge. So this is real philosophy. So philosophy is the process of knowledge which leads one out of the material existence. That's philosophy in the real sense. That's again, I compared that word philosophy with the word darshan in Sanskrit, which means to have the vision of the absolute truth. So, that's not Buddhism. Buddhism does not lead one out of the material world at all. Buddhism does not propose any alternative to the material world at all. There is this material world, and then there's just, you know, the absence of any consciousness of anything. Just total emptiness. So therefore, this is called Mayavad, and the Advaita Vedantas are also called Mayavadis. Because really their philosophy is just about Maya. Their whole reference is this material world, and they negate it. That's all. You see? But they have nothing else. They're just the material world, and they negate it. So, you know, whether I'm lifting it up or setting it down, I'm attached to it, right? You see? So, rejecting the material world, trying to negate it, I'm still attached to it. I'm still dealing only with this matter. Therefore, it's mind one place. And so it doesn't lead to liberation. How can it? Because there's no alternative.
Certain Mayavadis proudly refer to themselves as Mayavadis.
Yes. Because it is in their own writings. They call themselves one of their, I don't think it was Shankaracharya, but one of the, you know, near acharyas to him later has christened them with this name. We are Mayavadis. I was told this by that BNK Sharma, you know, that Madhva scholar.
That's the term used in Chaitanya Charitamrita. So what pride, what is the source of the pride for saying that?
Well, one thing Shankaracharya did say, he did write in his Shariraka Bhasya, and that the only thing that truly exists is Brahman, and therefore the perception of this universe, this Jagat, is not real. So there is nothing except Brahman. He's making this point. So therefore, the universe is a big hallucination, a big mind, in the sense of illusion. And so the Mayavadis, who come after there, they love this. This is for them nectar. Everything's an illusion. So they proudly embrace this term, Mayavadi. We say, the world is illusion.
It's all Maya.
Yeah, it's all Maya. Therefore, you see, the logic of this brings you, where does it bring you? It brings you up to, you know, modern times, people like Osho, who wrote a book called Sambhoga Se Samadhi. You know, you can achieve somebody by sex. Why not? Because everything's illusion anyway, so it doesn't matter. You just have to be aware that it's an illusion while you're engaged in it. This is what Prabhupada says. They say everything is illusion. Direct quote from Prabhupada. The Mayavadis say everything is an illusion, but they're very expert in enjoying that illusion.
Yeah. I spent some time in Thailand, which is really, that's Theravada, the hardcore Buddhism. So most people are not at all philosophical. So sometimes I'd speak with people, I'm just trying to work it out, what's their mindset. Because Thailand is also famous as a great place of material enjoyment. Because this Theravada Buddhism is supposed to be like hardcore austerity, and total giving up of this material world. So, for instance, I asked one woman once that, so you're eating pig, and in your next life, then you'll become a pig. You'll say, well, that will also be enjoyment. Because in Thailand, the main motive, in what's the final cause?
The purpose, yes.
The purpose, yeah. Is sanuk, is pleasure, good. Sensual pleasure. Everything should be, so that will also be sanuk. That will also be enjoyment. So I came to the conclusion that when I first read this in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada's purport, that both the Sarnath Buddhists and the Kashi Mayavadis are ultimately gross materialists. I couldn't understand this, but then I understood that in Buddhism, the goal is not very relishable, to just become nothing. And it's also very difficult to attain. You have to go through so many austerities. And the alternative is just to enjoy this material world, so you might as well get on with it. And that's what it comes to, actually. That's, Thailand is the evidence of that.
Yeah.
That's a little comment, don't I? I'm pinging on you, something like that.
Your comments are most welcome. They're seasoning everything with gems of illumination. Anything else? Yes?
No, I was just thinking of explaining a little more. how Brahman is cause of all universes. And you see that directly is Mahavishnu's role in Pradhana, and in this sense, in the sense of energy.
Well, the universes, if one were able to look from the standpoint of the universe out, then it would appear that the universe is coming out of Brahma-jyoti. But that is yasya prava, it is the effulgence of the Lord. So the universe is actually coming out of the core of Mahavishnu, where it is held in potential, and the Lord's body is effulgent. So this is how it appears. And also that prava is surcharged with all creative energies, that all the mystic powers, the astasiddhis, are there in complete fullness. And it's the astasiddhis nourish. You know, it says the universe comes out as a little golden seed and gradually grows, so it's being nourished by the astasiddhis that are streaming out of the body of the Lord. Because of presence. Yes.
You mentioned that Pradhan is unmanifested. It's something similar to like a void. It may appear like. So these modern scientists, they also say that before the creation it was void. So maybe they are hinting somewhat to that same Pradhan, unmanifested, but they are not able to understand.
Yeah, they're of course, modern science is all presented in this jargon language, which is difficult to penetrate. But from what I've understood of it, I've also noticed that they talk about potentia. They use this term, behind or beyond matter as we experience. There's something they call potentia. So Srila Prabhupada says pradhan is the potential form of the material energy. Maybe it's better to say the potential formlessness of the material energy. Because, you see, pradhan is something that our consciousness can't enter. You see, there's no interface with pradhan. So therefore, Sukadeva Goswami says, shunyavat, it's the experience of it is like a void. This is the susupti state, when a living entity is are drawn back into the body of Mahavishnu, then they're merged into this pradhan, which is otherwise known as achit shakti. It is the Lord's energy, which is, there's no consciousness appears there. So the living entities, they're just blanked out. They're in total tamoguna. So much so that they're not even aware of their existence. They don't know that they exist. There's so much covered by tamoguna. So this is mula prakriti. Mula prakriti is primordial tamas in its ultimate essence. So if one enters that, one loses all consciousness of anything. Nothing more. Yeah? You understand?
We all know that Saint Tukaram, Maharashtra, Dhyaneshwari, and he went back to Vaikunth within this body, and everybody accepts that. But in his writings, in his Abhangas, he's writing that that is dualistic concept, what he believes. We should follow this, and the Advaitic concept is beyond the human conceptions. It is there, but it is not for humans to be made by God to understand.
Yes.
So we should leave it. Yes. So on one hand there is some avid contamination, on the other hand he's going back to back on time in his body and
I'm not a student of the Abhangas, so, but what you have said reminds me of a statement of Bhaktivinoda Thakur in a work called Vaishnava Siddhantamala. And he writes there that there is in the Absolute Truth Abheda and Bheda. That means difference and oneness. So the difference is for the jiva. You see? We are different from Krishna. The oneness is for Krishna. Krishna is one with everything. Who can say he's not? He's one with everything. He's in our heart, he's in every atom. Everything is his energy. He has full authority. So oneness is real. But that's Krishna's standpoint. You see? We cannot keep Krishna out from anything. And that's why he's one with everything. But we cannot say that. We cannot. No jiva can say, I'm one with everything. Not possible. So Veda is... That's what I thought of when I heard you say this. Yeah, Veda difference is for us. And oneness, not just that it's, you know, beyond somewhere. That's Krishna's position.
So Maharaj, when I went even to Shantipur and other Acharya was preaching about Advaita Siddhanta and Ivan Vegan. Then the statement Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Advaita Acharya, that you don't preach Advaita philosophy, but actually we understand Advaita philosophy, the actual context. So maybe this is the explanation. But then my explanation.
Yeah, the mistake is when the jiva is thinking that he can assume that position of oneness with everything. That's why this Advaita philosophy is misleading. Because that's what it is teaching. You become one with everything. And that's not within the jiva's power to do that. If Krishna wasn't one with everything, then what would be the use of our deity worship? And Srila Prabhupada used to ridicule the Mayavadis. The Mayavadis, their argument would be that why should I bow down to this deity when God is everywhere? And Prabhupada would reply, well, so if God is everywhere, it means he's also in the deity. So bow down. And you see, within oneness, there is also, even within Krishna's... That's another thing, is that this oneness, it doesn't mean that Krishna is not a person. You see, we accept Krishna's oneness with everything as a person. That is also, must be understood. The Mayavadis twist it further by saying God is impersonal. So person means a person has his purposes. So just like, here's an example. Water is also everywhere. You see, each of these Mahabhutas, earth, water, fire, is pervading everything. You see? And even scientifically, scientists will agree, yes, water is in the air, water is in our body, water is here in this garland, there is water. You see? But when you want to drink, when you need to quench your thirst, can you just get it from the air? Oh, just finish. No. There's a place you have to go. Here. To this dispenser, and you take the water. A faucet. And you drink. So this is purposeful, you see. There's oneness. Water is everywhere. But still, it's purposeful. If you want to take advantage of the water to quench your thirst, you have to go there. With a cup. So God is everywhere. Yes. But if you want to see him, worship him, he appears as the deity. Not that God is everywhere. Oh, here. Oh, John. Mo Namaha. This is my Ishti David.
May I tell a little humorous anecdote in this regard? Going back many years, as I was walking on the street in Patna once, and two young men came up to me and asked, what is this Krishna consciousness all about? And so I was explaining to them, and then one man came up and he started listening and objecting, and saying, why are you saying God is a person, God is everything? So then there's some pigs running on the street, and I said, so you worship God in your home? Yes. Are you prepared to take this pig to your home and worship as God? Yes. Are you prepared to take that pig stool and worship as God? Yes. This is the foolishness of my life.
And you know, in this famous tantric, you know, so-called sadhana, they actually have sadhanas or practices to realize this. It is said that Ramakrishna, the not the real Ram, you know who I'm talking about, Gadadhar Chatterjee, that's his real name, that when he was coming to his so-called enlightenment, that he spent some time meditating like this. And in one hand he had sandalwood pulp, and the other hand he had dog stool. And he was meditating to see that they're both the same. We talk about dogmatic wanting everything to be the same. So he's keeping in one hand dog stool and in another hand sandalwood pulp to realize that there's no difference between the two. And in this tamasic tantra, they have all kinds of nasty things like that. They do.
It's also said about Vivekananda when he was in America. So he was dining out and they were serving beef. And he said, Swamiji, you say everything's one, then what's your inhibition here about just eating beef? And he said, true, and he had it.
Yes. Yeah, that's the story you hear in America. I found no one in India knows this, because Vivekananda, you know, he's still very much respected here. But in America, it's known. He was taken somewhere to eat by his disciples, and beef was served, and he didn't want to take it. And one of the Americans who had been hearing his lectures, he said, but Swamiji, you say everything is one. And he said, yeah, that's right, I do. All right. And he took. Yeah?
Guru Maharaj, can you explain this term, causal body? Because I'm sometimes really confused to get it. What
my goodness, causal body. Karana deha.
Yes.
Yeah, karana deha, linga sharira, and stula sharira. So. But this is a nice point, that because we're talking about the stages of creation, so at the Mahavishnu level of creation, he's called Karanadakarsha Vishnu, the cause of Vishnu. So at that level of creation, those associates who are with him, like Lord Shiva and others, also four Kumaras are on that level. So they have causal bodies, Karana Deha, manifest with all siddhis, everything. So we also have a causal body in potential, which is, and it's the cause of our material existence. This is the place where our desires are. It's the root of the mind. The Prabhupada calls it the subconscious. It is also called alaya in some philosophies, philosophical writings. The alaya vijnana. So subconscious. So there all the desires are, the vasanas. All our desires. So it's the root of our material existence. In that sense, Karana Deha. And then those desires manifest in the mind, that's the Linga Sharira, the subtle body, and they're enacted in the Stula Sharira, the gross body. Was that clear? Okay.
Can I explain that sleeping, you tell Mahavishnu sleeping and the souls are there, I didn't understand that. How the souls are there?
Souls are in the body of Mahavishnu. Yes, you know that, I think.
Yeah, I know.
Yes.
I read from Brahma Samhita.
Yes, so Mahavishnu, he's laying down in a mystic sleep, Prabhupada calls it, called Yoga Nidra. Actually, he's laying down and he's dreaming, so to speak, or he's transcendentally visualizing his own pastimes in Goloka Vrindavan, because he's Krishna, you see. So this is his dream, so to speak. So it's not a dream like we have, it's his leela. So Prabhupada calls this also Yoga Maya. This Yoga Nidra is Yoga Maya, he says. So this means this is the actual manifest pastime of the Lord in the spiritual world, and this is what Mahavishnu is contemplating. But the living entities who are within his body, because their relationship to the Lord, you see, is imitative. They're in that position because obviously they're not serving the Lord. They're not his servants. They want to imitate him. So this is, he does this lila, giving the chance to living entities, okay, you can imitate me. I'm laying down, I'm in nidra. He's contemplating his own pastimes in the spiritual world. These living entities are just in tamoguna. Understand?
But the desire develops by seeing the Lord dreaming his own pastimes. That's where the jiva develops a desire to imitate. Also
yes, imitate. The jiva is also, yes, you experience at night. We are also, when we sleep at night, we're in deep sleep, susupti, unconsciousness, and then from out of that, dreams arise, and we enter the dream world. And these dreams are our desires, you see, in a kind of muddled form, subtle form. Alright, so, yes, you're the temple manager. This will be the last question from the temple manager.
I heard one phenomenon that souls, when they, after destruction in the universe, they have to, not self-realize, so they have to take birth in another creation, they have to come again. When they enter into body of Mahavishnu, they say that they are in dual consciousness.
There?
They are in dual consciousness of body of Mahavishnu.
In pure consciousness?
They are in pure consciousness.
In pure consciousness.
Then
the it is also considered a kind of Brahman realization. But it's, you see, within Brahman there is these Shaktis. So there is this Achit Shakti. So they are merged in the Achit Shakti. So their experiences of, again, Sushupti. So in that sense, they're pure because they're not engaged in any material activities. And they're there with the Lord. But their consciousness is in suspension.
It's like sleeping conditions.
Yes. And Prabhupada says the Buddhists, they aspire for that. To be merged into this Achichakti or Pradhan. That's their goal. That's the void that they want to realize. So in a sense, you see, in a sense, it is pure. But it is not eternal. It is pure because it represents the cessation of material activity, impure material activities. But it is not eternal because that pradhan in which they merge is the ingredient of the next creation. You see? So there they are. And when it comes out, they will come out too. And when it manifests, they will manifest with it. And then all their desires will come out, which were just covered, and again.
Therefore the word abhishuddha. Shuddha, but not vishuddha. Abhishuddha buddha.
That's a good point. Abhishuddha. So, shuddha, okay.
Pure, but not, yes. Not fully pure.
Yes. Pure, but not purified.
Anavrita Yashvadamyeha, because they neglect to worship Krishna's lotus feet.
Excuse me, Maharaj. Like in Mahavishnu's body, there are countless number of souls. Only few souls think of imitating, or all the souls think? Because I heard Prabhupada saying there is only 25% in material world, 75% spiritual.
Well, you know, we're talking, when you talk about 25%, 10%, this, that, we're talking about the percentage of infinity. So that will also be infinity.
So the souls keep thinking and Mahavishnu keeps creating, it is like that, it's infinite, nitya. All
it's a nitya lila, yeah. Nitya. There's no beginning and end to it.
Okay.
I wanted to stop with our temple manager. All right, this will be the last one.
Well, it's about also about Buddhists that the Prabhupada is saying in the first canto that Buddha is an incarnation of Krishna, so Buddhists are worshipping Krishna indirectly. So they're also making spiritual blasphemy. And in the same time, if they're saying that it's all nonsense and they're like they have this parody mentality, so how can they make an answer?
Well, over a long time. You see, there is definitely a lot of value for a living entity, you know, I mean, rather than engage in hellish sinful activities, to follow the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism, which is actually what Lord Buddha taught, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Noble Path, which basically means four regulative principles. There's also a development in Buddhism where you see not in this Theravada, which is otherwise known as Hinayana, lesser vehicle, that there's in Japan, China, Tibet, in Korea, there's the Mahayana, the greater vehicle of Buddhism. So there you see the appearance of the conception and worship of Adi Buddha, the original Buddha. And he exists, they say, you know, there's a void, but beyond the void, there's Adi Buddha. And this, how he's depicted, always reminds me of a super soul or Mahavishnu. They even say he's lying in, he's in a kind of trance state, and his thoughts or his dreams in his mind are this what we're experiencing. So, some of these Buddhist sects they worship the form of Adi Buddha. In Japan, there's a sect called Shingon Buddhism. And they have big, big statues of Adi Buddha. And they have arti for him and fire sacrifice and chanting mantras. And one should chant the name of Adi Buddha. There's different names. So this is obviously some kind of bhakti. It's still mixed up with a lot of speculation. And a lot of impersonalism is there too. But you can see something is developing. And because Buddha is the avatar of the Lord, we cannot say that that's in vain. We cannot just say it's all useless. So, but it will take time. Like Srila Prabhupada in Mayapur, Prabhupada would sometimes kind of sitting in his seat, doze off, you know, in the afternoon. And so once he kind of awoke from such a little nap like that, and then he told his disciples who were there that, "I just dreamed of the heavenly planet where the Muslims go." And, you know, Prabhupada said it with such conviction that those disciples who heard him say that were thinking Prabhupada not just dreamed, he saw that place. So Prabhupada says Muhammad is also Shakti Veshavatar. So there's so many things in Islam that, you know, we won't talk about. So many things. But it's not that it's totally divine in the Gami.
Prabhupada means that these Buddhists who are worshipping the Adi Buddha, I mean, this is the real term of Buddhism.
Huh?
He said then that Prabhupada is meaning the Buddhists who are worshipping Adi Buddha.
What do you mean?
Otherwise, I mean like, you said there's like, because Buddhists have, you know, like, especially in this new age, you know, time, you know, many people say that they are Buddhists, but they don't have any understanding of it.
Well, you see, Lord Buddha came with a mission of attracting the atheists to himself, to get them away from the terrible things they were doing, slaughtering animals in the name of the Vedas.
They were atheists, so he preached a doctrine that was attractive to them. So, yes, atheists and demons and all kinds of nonsense people flock to Buddhism. No doubt. And that goes on to this very day. And they even have such slogans as, it's famous, I've even seen a book with the title, it's a Buddhist slogan from some sect. You see, because there's so much speculation, so there's so many different schools of Buddhism. It's very hard to say, you know, to generalize Buddhism, you know, very tightly together. But in some Buddhist schools, there's this saying, and I saw it as a title of a book that if you meet Buddha on the road, kill him. Which means you have to rid yourself of, you know, the personal conception entirely, and that means kick out the Buddha also. See, or kill him. You know, this is demoniac, obviously. If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Your own founder, Acharya. So this is the kind of people who become attracted to it. So yeah, there's so much nonsense, true. But all I'm saying is Buddha is Krishna, incarnation of Krishna nonetheless. And there is, because there's some devotional sentiment, therefore it has developed to some point where, you know, there you see the emergence of some kind of, you know, semblance of Vaishnavism on some level or other appears. Like the names of the Adi Buddha, I've seen the names they chant. One of them is Jagannath. Another one is Niranjan. These are names of the Lord, names of Krishna. So Buddhists are chanting Jagannath, Niranjan, and other names. They're going to get benefit, no doubt. All right, so that was it. We stopped. Thank you.